Hi, and welcome to Song Divers, an interview podcast about singer-songwriters.
We like to go deep in conversation with our favorite musicians in search of honest answers.
What are the ingredients of a great song?
What makes a songwriter tick?
Can a musician make a living these days?
Is Jason Isbell overrated?
What?
My name is Stefan.
And this is Ed. We're really excited to bring you part two of our conversation with one of the finest singer-songwriters in America today.
Hey, I'm Jesse Terry.
I turn on the TV, I look out a window, it's easy to lose faith, get caught in the undertow.
Welcome to part two of our conversation with Jesse Terry, an award-winning singer-songwriter from Connecticut by way of Nashville.
Always think the world can change and I carry that with me.
To spend time with Jesse and his music is to feel that you've just made a new friend. In part one, we got to know Jesse a little bit as he shared some of his stories and insights about his life in music.
To carry that with me.
We're excited to dive back in for part two of our interview with Jesse. For more thoughts on his creative process, on what lies ahead, and how songwriting for him became a way out of dark times into the light.
We hope you enjoy the episode. So, in terms of songwriting, are you a... It never occurred to me to ask if someone was a title-first songwriter, but, like, are you a music-first or a lyrics-first songwriter?
Well, I'm definitely a music and, like, title person first. Like, as many titles as I probably have more, like, audio clips with, like, no titles. You know, just... Maybe I'll say, like, whatever vibe I think it has, you know, or just like really cool work on this one, you know, that's like the title of it, you know, and then I go back to it and often those become songs because those are times where you're not thinking and the music is flowing through you, you know, so you have to like capture that because when you're just sitting down, it doesn't always do that, you know, so I have a ton of those, and then titles.
Are you a member of the club that you start singing or like words? You find words just
The gibberish
coming out of your mouth. Do they form words, and then you're like, maybe this song is about X.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can maybe hear words later. I love the gibberish like approach, and I love like hearing like the frit like. Picking up on that phrasing when you are being really natural and not editing yourself and not being hard on yourself and just picking up on that phrasing and even like what vowels sound good. Like it might be that you just revisit that and say, well, that vowel really needs to be like an O sound there. Cause that's magic right there.
I know that about you from writing with you. Like,
I hope I'm not like a Nazi. About
no,
that.
I vowel think it's, Nazi. I think it's really interesting because you'll think of a way to like how the words sound coming out of my mouth.
And right.
Like, a lot of times I feel like I'm just the opposite. Like I'll find a way to fit a word I want in there.
Right.
You know, even if it doesn't sound the most natural.
Like, but that's cool
I'm
too.
I'm going to find a way to jam it in there.
I mean, I dig that too. It's just a cool, it's cool that those titles you can, you know, and I look back at my title list and I'm like, oh, like these are down at like the second and third page or whatever. Like I keep them there as reminders because like they've turned into songs that have been on records, you know? So that'll give me confidence when I look back over the other titles to be like, don't give up on these quite yet. Like there might be a title in there and that can lead to something. And I think brainstorming is really cool and like, object writing and stream of consciousness writing, kind of the artist's way approach. I think that's very cool. Something I need to do more of. Just like you always can do more reading, you know, you can always do more object writing and more, you know, just it. And you, if you do that before a song, it just gives you so much extra material and just cool words and cool, you know, descriptions and adjectives and, mm-hmm. and smells and tastes and feel, you know what I mean? It just makes...
Is that something you picked up from Berkeley?
Yeah, I think that's probably more of a Berkeley thing, which is probably why I don't do it, you know, as much as I should, you know, before. Even though I'm a big fan of that stuff, I just kind of got away from that really structured stuff. But I do think that, like, stream of consciousness writing and being open and kind of meditating on an object or a thought or something, that's not really structured at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually quite beautiful to do that, you know?
Yeah.
So I should do that more before songs. I'm like, learning here as well, too, and, like, reminding myself, like, what's important about being a writer, and reading is so important, you know?
I was going to ask, you know, like, honing that mechanism or honing that id, almost, you know, like you mentioned wanting, like, you hadn't picked up a pencil and drawn in a while and maybe you want to do that again. Like, are you doing other things to sort of feed that creative side of you that help sort of, you know, cross train?
Not as much, like, you mean like visual art?
Or like you said, reading or other things that are sort of just putting other things to use, you know, like putting other types of fuel.
I'm trying to just force myself to read more and, like, read great stuff, like, you know, Steinbeck and, mm-hmm. you know, like, really, really great authors. Because all the really great songwriters, like Joni Mitchell, you know, like, brilliant people, mm-hmm. you know? And, so I'm forcing myself to do that, but you know, it's definitely something that you have to be aware of, because, like, after touring and if you have a family and, like, promotion and emails and booking and all that stuff, that there has to be a balance there. And that's a hard balance to find. And for me, like, just going through, like, the season of writing for multiple records and then releasing multiple records, like, how much work that is, like, working with multiple publicists and mm-hmm. UK and US and radio promoters and doing all that stuff, I got really sucked into that for a while, and I think it was vital that I did, but now that I'm getting back to, like, writing songs and getting into La La Land, I'm remembering, like, how much I love that, mm-hmm. and, like, how much I need that, you know, like, and I'm not posting as much, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not, like, we've gotten some record reviews lately, or some different stuff that I could have posted about, and I was like, I'm gonna write, you know, like, I need to write, like, it's, you can't get, there has to be a balance, you know. I don't think it should be all one thing. I mean, if you're an indie, like, you can't just write, you know, you need to learn, you know, I can't really afford, like, great digital marketing right now, so, like, I'm taking a course on digital marketing. So I do that, like, on some days, mm-hmm. you know, and I work on that, but I can't, I'm not a digital marketer, you know, I'm not going to do that, like, all the time. But I think it was important for me to do that. And, like, partly because I can't afford, it right now.
But you, I mean, you've made a living for 10 years.
Yeah.
Almost 9 years.
Yeah.
Doing this, you know, I think that's one of the things that was fascinating for me, at least, about.
So grateful for that, man.
Well, you're not with a band. You're not traveling with a band. It's you. You're not signed to a label, but you have management, you have publicists, you know. And I think some of that
booking,
probably there was
really important.
And you grew up with an awareness that this could be a profession, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So that was probably both a luxury and you know, a challenge.
Yeah.
You know, in many ways probably.
Yeah.
But I remember the first time I saw you probably was maybe 2012 or 2013, something like that.
Oh,
maybe.
Yeah.
But you were touring through by yourself. And I'm like, what do you mean this guy doesn't have a band and he's just here? Like, you can do that? I don't, you know, I mean, like, you know, but it's done. But
I might have not had an apartment at that point. But
you had the car.
I had the car. There's
you see those people, but they're, you know, they are like the best people at an open mic night. And then you see musicians that come through that you're like, what? No, this is a real deal. You know, and it doesn't, I don't know that it occurs to a lot of people. It certainly didn't to me. And I had been touring in a band for a while that like you could just do this by yourself. You don't need a label or like, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So do you think there are times you wish you were touring with a band or that you would find that more liberating or enjoyable or?
Yeah, definitely. Especially when I play with like really great people, you know, and I'm just like, oh man, that's so beautiful. And that's really adding to like what I'm doing. And I mean, Ed's one of those people, you know, I mean, so.
I do know actually. Yes.
So. You do, I know, firsthand. I mean, so there's part of it, and then there's part of it that's like, you know, I tour with my wife and now my daughter and my rescue lab mix, Harrison, you know, and like, so it's very full.
And you're all in the Fiat. How do you do it?
We're all, yeah. Well, yeah. We used to have a Corolla. We just bought a minivan. It was a neat, and we need like a roof rack now too, which is just really upsetting. But I mean, like it's great fun, you know, and for the most part, you know, and I love the fact that you can play solo and captivate an audience. And there's something really liberating about that. And there's something really beautiful that there's nothing in the way, you know what I mean? There's not, sometimes with, I love the full band shows, but sometimes that gets in the way or it gets in the way of the lyric or the vocal. It can, you know, depending on the venue, depending on the band.
Well, that's the thing, know? Too. I mean, and, you know, so, we talk about the Hideaway, and there's even bad nights at that venue, you know, but and I'm sure it's true of a lot, but
yeah, sure.
Finding a venue that truly allows you, when you're a singer-songwriter like that, really, giving you a venue or an avenue to actually have somebody hear your song, you know, and
right.
You don't hear the murmur of people talking and... You know, there's so many different places you can play that are considered great venues and could be great bands and people are there to hear you, but they're still doing other things or socializing during it. And,
right.
You know, so it's, you know, for anybody that takes it for granted, you can just go find a place, sit on stage and not be affected by when you're singing something really intimate or that is, you know, very lyrically dense or driven or, you know, nuanced and it has to land. Otherwise it feels like it's a bad feeling.
Yeah, it's a terrible feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you don't want that. And it drives me crazy when people are talking and stuff. So I've been through that. You know?
Yeah.
Like I had to make a living for a while playing covers, you know, like when I started, you know. And then like it became like half covers and half original gigs. And then at a certain point it became all original gigs. And so now I'm just not accustomed to like people being rude, you know. So it just drives me crazy.
Well, it doesn't occur to some people.
You know, I'm not too bad with it. I don't get into many fist fights, but you know, it's something that I try to avoid.
Yeah.
Even when someone else is playing a song.
Totally.
You know, I just,
you don't get in too many fist fights.
Right. Occasionally I do get into some.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, everybody does, right?
Yeah. That's literally what you just said. You said you don't get in too many fist fights.
Right. You need a good fight every once in a while, you know?
Jesse,
a lot of that in the folk world.
Stargazer was being played to somebody who's leaving this world, but that's because Jesse had injured him so badly in a fist fight.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
He was talking.
He's kind enough to sing it to him after that.
Well, you want to play another song for us?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think, you know, in the interest of time, kind of bringing it back in terms of, I'm really interested in what you think in terms of your journey. Some of your highlights, you know, and
right.
I think one of the ones that you wanted you to play for us, Let the Blue Skies Go to Your Head, that got picked up, right? By the show, and you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, that song, like, saved my career, because my wife, I've been on two, like, you know, homeless kind of address, I don't want to say homeless, but, well, we didn't have a home or an apartment, so I guess I can
say, by definition,
I can say that, but, you know, just tours where we really couldn't afford to have an apartment, you know. The first one was that first tour that I booked. I didn't know what the heck I was doing, you know, at all, and didn't have any fans. So it was mainly house concerts and just weird gigs. Like, you know, I played it. I mean, not to offend any nudists out there, but, you know, I played a nudist resort.
No, I don't think they're worried about offending anybody. So
yeah, no. I mean, I have no problem with it. I just different kind of, you just took any gig you could get. You know, I played for a cover.
Did you have to play nude also?
No. I mean, I probably would have
right.
at that point. You know, it was $500,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. I'd have done it for two.
I'd probably do that for now. But So getting to that, that second tour, I remember just being like, my wife got a job in New York City after that first tour, and we moved to Westchester, New York, just outside of New York City, and I was touring full time, and my wife was working full time in the city, and it was just killing us, you know. Even though like her job had room for advancement and all that, you know, all that grown up stuff, but we were apart so much that it was just killing us and killing our relationship and all of that stuff. So I was in St. Pete when she called me, and she called me and said, "Is it okay if I quit my job and we move back into the car?" And I said, "Absolutely, you know, like, what, you know, what took you so long?" You know, and so we did another 9 months together out on the road, just me and Jess and our dog too, our old dog Jackson Brown. And I remember getting that email after we lost our shirt in Europe on our first European tour, and we pulled into Paddington Station, and that email was, I believe that was where it was waiting for me, and we were just out of money, like, and no credit cards or anything. I went bankrupt like that year, I think. I mean, it was just like not a good money time. Not like now where I'm like loaded with cash, you know. like it was just a really low point financially. It was a high point in my life, but money was not part of that equation. So yeah, getting that email and from Warner Brothers or this, the music supervision company that did this show called Heart of Dixie, which I had never heard of before, but they offered me this amount of money for my song. And I said, "Yes, please." You know, where do I sign, and how fast can you get it to London? You know? Mm-hmm. And that, so, I mean, without that song, I'm not sure what I would have done that year.
Yeah. Well, let's hear it.
Yes, every driver, about a quarter to nine, you can hear the boardwalk and the carnival rides, and it's much too early just to sit at home. But you only see thorns as they hand you a rose as you lean on the hood of his car. His engine's warm, he's waiting for you. Tell me what you got to lose. It's so hard for you to believe in something real, yeah. You're always counting on rain. Life's always gonna fall the same. Oh, don't go inside, don't you play dead. Honey, let the blue skies go to your head. See a flash of your childhood in his halogen lights. You can picture him leaving without a goodbye. You gotta push that away, girl, or you'll never get out. And this cruel old world will keep crumbling down. You ain't always gonna be this young. His engine's warm, he's waiting for you. Tell me what you got to lose. It's so hard for you to believe in something real. You're always counting on rain. Like it's always gonna fall the same. Oh, don't go inside, don't you play dead. Honey, let the blue skies go to your head. Oh, well, it's a long, hard fall. But you can't lose them all. Oh, you're always counting no rain, like it's always gonna fall the same. Oh, don't go inside, don't you play dead, honey, let the blue skies go to your head. Don't go inside, don't you play dead, honey, let the blue skies go to your head.
So if that song is one of the ones that, like you said, I mean, you know, basically saved you at that point.
Yeah.
Is the song's lyrical, you know, content something really meaningful and special also?
I think it was just written.
Or is it just drivel?
It's mainly just drivel, like all the rest of them.
Just insincere. And
I think it was just written to maybe myself and maybe a bunch of other people as well, just kind of that feeling of when things are really good, you have more to lose. And I mean, like right now, I mean, like, you know, I mean, just the feeling of having a 5-month-old little girl, you know, is just, I love her so much. Like that fear is like nothing I've ever experienced, you know, like that amount of love creates like this fear. So, I mean, the song is kind of about that, is like you have to feel that fear and still be able to go on with your life and mm-hmm. and not believe that like the rug's gonna get pulled out from you and everything's gonna just turn to shit.
In terms of like the lyrics being super dense or deep, no, but the message and the way everything, I heard an interview with Leno recently and he's talking about comedians and the way that like they could be saying something really simple, but there's almost like a lyrical, musical quality to the way that they lay words out. And I think that song especially is almost more impressive in that it is a fairly straightforward message of exactly what you said, which is like, you know, you got to take your chances and don't be scared. But just like lyrics like, you know, you're always counting on rain, like it's always going to fall the same. You know, just that idea of like it's, you know, the same dark cloud hanging over you and the way that phrase falls, like it's just stuff like that I think is really special about that song.
Oh, cool.
I think one of my favorite lines is you can't lose them all. Because it kind of turns, you can't win them all, turns it on its head.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's like you can't lose them all. You might win, you know.
Right. You might actually get lucky as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can't all be sad songs. Can't all be depressing.
Yeah.
As much as I'd love that.
I was going to say. That's the most relatable.
No, but I mean like, yeah, I mean, I come from
all
a back.
All of mine are depressing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ed's got some great depressing songs.
Yeah, even if they're upbeat, they make you depressed.
I mean, but like they make you feel like you're not alone. You know what I mean? Like it's like a Jackson Brown thing or like, you know.
They make me feel like I want to be alone.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah.
And now, a quick ditty about one of the companies supporting this podcast. Songdivers is proudly recorded in St. Petersburg, Florida. One of the reasons we love this area is due to how beautiful many of the homes and businesses are here. Well, many of those picturesque facades are due to the lush and tasteful work of Ryan's Green Design, one of the best landscaping and horticultural companies in the Southeast U.S. Their work can be seen from South Florida to South Carolina and on their social media channels. Whether it's updating your garden or a commercial retail center, getting a hold of Ryan's Green Design should be your first step. We can't wait to work with them on our next project, which we hope will be a new studio in our hometown. To see their work and get started on your next green space project, visit songdivers.com/green for a free quote. And now, back to the interview.
I think, I mean, I'm looking forward to writing for the next stuff that I'm doing. Like, I think we're going to do some singles and then, of course, another album, you know, or two or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I'm enjoying like digging farther back into my childhood as well. And cause you know, for a little while, I think because I did have such a rough childhood, and turbulent kind of upbringing, I feel like a lot of my songwriting was about turning stuff around. And I think people, you know, think of me as a fairly positive dude, and like, you know, I think my songwriting for the most part reflects that. Even if I'm singing something that's like negative, sometimes like it doesn't feel negative, you know, it's just kind of that was kind of my way out, you know. That was my music was my you know, my lifeboat, you know. So like
it so does, you find yourself revisiting some of that childhood turmoil and
kind yeah.
of like turning it into a...
And now that's becoming like, you know, revisiting some of that and like being okay with writing some stuff as well that's kind of that's darker is kind of healing in a way, because you can let go of it and you can let go of the anger that you have towards, or the sadness that you have towards some of those people or some of those situations. And
tell us a little bit about one of them, because I co-wrote a song with you.
Oh, the one we wrote together
called Stay Low.
Yeah. So I haven't told many people this whole story. I won't tell the whole story because I know this is not like a 4-hour podcast, but
my ways are yours.
And like, it's not a therapy. Well, it's kind of is therapy. This is all therapy yeah. and healing. And, but yeah, I mean, I shouldn't say I left home. I got sent away when I was very young, like around 12. Now, as I said, my parents split when I was young. And I think my parents thought, okay, we might have dodged a bullet here. I think the kids turned out pretty like normal, even though like, you know, when they were growing up, we were doing whatever. We were drinking, we were drugging, we were really good people and loved us, but doing some pretty crazy stuff as well.
Did you have a big family? You have a bunch of brothers and sisters?
Just one sister. So a pretty small family. And we spent most of our upbringing, after the split, we spent most of our time with my mom and my stepfather, who's no longer part of the family. But around 12, like around age 12 or so, I don't know what happened. Like something changed in my like chemistry, my brain chemistry, and I just went nuts. Like I had so much anger, you know. Like I was just,
which is hard to imagine because every time I've seen you and met you, I mean, I'd say 99% of the time there's a smile on your face, and part of that's probably because you just really enjoy what you're doing, and I would too. But
life has changed.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine you with.
I do still have road rage. Like I'm still working through that, and like listening to like The Art of Happiness by or what is it, the Dalai Lama book. I love that. It's the greatest book. But yeah, I mean, at that point, I mean, I was breaking windows, and I was, you know, I just remember just being so angry. Like how could you guys be such bad parents? You know what I mean? And just feeling very betrayed and you know, it was just a rough time. And I think that led to like having no respect for authority. So like, you know, I was 12 years old, and if a teacher asked me to do something, I'd just say, you know, go F yourself, you know, I mean, for truth, you know, like,
wow.
And these teachers just didn't know what to think, you know? So I got sent away to Yale, New Haven, like psychiatric hospital, when I was like 12 or something like that. And I wasn't crazy. Like I was a really angry kid. I needed love. I didn't need that, you know, that wasn't what I needed. It was very intense. It was a lockup kind of thing. It felt like prison, you know, like if you didn't obey what they were saying, they put you in restraints. It was very much like a movie or like a Gothica or kind of, it felt like that, you know, like,
And you're 12 or 13?
It's like 12 and a half, you know? And so I got out of there after a few months and went back home. And that at that point, like after your parents send you something somewhere like that, you really don't want to be around them. You know what I mean? It didn't help, you know, like, it just made me want to create my life by myself even more. So I just kept getting into trouble, and then I got sent off to another psychiatric hospital, Silver Hills, in Connecticut.
That just sounds like a psychiatric hospital.
It's actually a beautiful place. Like my school system paid for it. I think it's like $50,000 a month or something. Like Michael Jackson, I think, went there, and some of the Allman Brothers.
This is where the songwriting happens.
This is the good stuff. Yeah, this is. I'm just being totally transparent with y'all.
Yeah,
And that's the thing. It takes a while to like not be ashamed of that. Like, you know what I mean? Like I don't even drink, you know what I mean? Like, but I'm happy to tell you about these things, or share it with the world because it's just, it's what happened, you know?
So what age are you now when you go for your second round?
So I'm probably like 13 or so.
Oh, so it was like
13 right and back. A half. Yeah, pretty much right back. I probably got into some trouble at school. They probably found some drugs or something, you know? I might have stolen it from my parents, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't really remember everything. But I know that Silver Hills was like this amazing experience. Like once I got out of the hospital, they send you down to live in these cottages. And, you know, I had my first kiss down. They were co-ed cottages, you know?
Oh, wow.
It was amazing. So
Silver Hills indeed.
It was beautiful. So I met all these like kids like me, and we only had school for a couple hours a day. And most of the kids just had, I mean, the only thing we all had in common were our families were a mess, you know? I'm sure there was probably some people there that were truly mental patients and, you know, had some real serious mental illness, and I'm not making light of that. You know, just most of us kids were just really like hurting, you know? So we had connections with each other that were just deeper than you could ever have, you know, with anyone else. And I love that place. And then unfortunately, like after 2 months and like probably 120,000 or whatever that my school system paid, they sent me to another place, like a reform kind of like residential treatment facility called Devereaux Glenholm, like the Glenholm School or something like that. Horrible place. Horrible. Like, I'm not even sure like what you can say, like if they can sue you for libel, but I just hate that school. Like, and a lot of stuff has come out about that school. Like people, I think like the guy who wrote like Silver Linings Playbook, like his kid went there, and I think he had Tourette's syndrome, which is a very, you know, serious thing that needs to be treated. And mm-hmm. he was raising money at this gala in New York City. And, you know, I experienced that school. So that just enraged me that, you know, I just wanted to write to him and be like, you know, I'm sure your son needs that school, but not everyone there needed that. You know, not everyone needed that. Like most of those kids needed nurturing. Mm-hmm. They didn't need to walk in straight lines and like, you know, if they talked back, to be thrown in a padded room. That's not what they needed. You know, and that kind of stuff happened to me. So it just shaped who I am, you know, and who I became. And so after I left there, I was there for like a year and a half or so. I did try to go home, but I only lasted home for about 3 months. Like my level of respect for my parents and all adults was so low.
Well, yeah, it sounds like, I mean, just a level of alienation.
Yeah, I was
really come back from.
I was just unable to really just have any respect, you know, for them or any trust, you know. So it just took a little while. And so I ran away and I just, you know, I did everything from, you know, inner city kind of runaway shelters to friends that had, you know, mansions in Connecticut with, you know, Ferraris in the driveway. It was just a very strange, to living with my grandparents, to living with my friend, my best friend Carlos, who was from Colombia. His whole family didn't, like, barely spoke English, so I lived with them for about a year. It was just a very interesting, you know, childhood. And and that just, you know, so.
And are you still going to school as you've run away? Like, I mean,
yeah, for the most part. Yeah, I mean, like, I was still going to school. I mean, there was different programs I went to at different times. Like a lot of it's like a big blur. You know, I know that I went to some different kind of high schools for like troubled kids and stuff mm-hmm. for a little while. And there's different programs they throw kids in. Unfortunately, there's nothing that really like puts a kid in a good situation as far as like a family life. They can't give you like brand new parents, mm-hmm. you know. As much as I love my parents now, like they can't give you parents that are, you know, clean and sober and say, you know, welcome home, son. Like mm-hmm. everything's like, let me, you know, you can trust me and here's the, you know. So it was just a really turbulent situation. And yeah, that, so at that residential school, the Devereaux School, Glenholme Devereaux, I forget what it's called. I think it's called the Glenholme School. But if anybody's thinking of sending their kids there, don't trust the fancy manicured gardens and lawns. It's a nightmare for kids. So I ran away from there as well. And Ed and I wrote a song about it called Stay Low. And, we all had different duties to do, and like it rotated. So I was on like,
One does in prison. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was on breakfast duty like one day or one week. And I planned the whole thing with my girlfriend. I don't think she made it, out, but she was supposed to plan a diversion and I was supposed to plan a diversion. Then we were both supposed to run out the back door. My diversion was to start a grease fire, like while cooking like bacon, which I did. And the fire went up the wall, and hopefully there's no like statute of limitations on this thing. hopefully there is, like, because I'm not sure how many people I've told this besides.
Yeah.
But you should definitely do accident, it on
a right? podcast that but we're going to put out for everyone to hear yet.
But it was definitely an accidental.
Yes, fire. It was an accidental fire that I meant.
You
to,
meant to cook the bacon.
I meant to cook the bacon extra well. Yeah,
so that's the way to put it. Going up the wall.
Yeah. So yeah, and so the staff, there's always staff members watching us, you know, at all times, 24/7. So they ran to go put out the fire, and I went running out the back door just as fast as I could run, and we were out in the country in Washington, Connecticut. The foot of like the Berkshires. I think James Taylor actually lived there at the time. And I just ran. I ran through the cornfields. I ran through the woods and stuff. I only got caught when it had been a few hours, and I decided to go back on the road just because I was like, it's really deep, dense woods, you know? And I was like, oh, I got out, you know? So Ed and I wrote a song all about that, you know? I had this plan and to meet, what kind of trees are they again, Ed?
Juniper
trees. I kind of researched what trees were up there, and I realized they were junipers, and that's where I was supposed to meet my girlfriend, but she never did show up. So Ed and I wrote a song called Stay Low about that. And that, you know, it's a great way to talk about that situation and to remember that and to remember those emotions, and it's very real.
Got your window on a stereo sky, nurture a flame and watch for the sun. And fly, kick up your magical heels and meet me by the juniper trees. Meet me by the juniper trees. Remember, stay low, gotta stay low. Escape before the savages know. Once we make it to the cone, we'll be home free. And we will hear the angels sing.
Not every song has to be that real and autobiographical, but if you do go through a situation where an accidental fire occurs and you run away and you happen to be in a residential treatment facility with padded rooms, like, you should write about that. You know what I mean? That's
absolutely.
Like you can make up fantasy stories and you can write about different people and characters, but you can also write about what's real to you and what's vulnerable. And I'm continuing to do that like more and more, but it took me a long time.
I can imagine. I don't know that I can, but as much as I can, yeah, that's a lot to unpack.
I mean, other kids had it much. There's a lot of other kids who had it much harder than me. I just feel like that these experiences eventually led me. Well, first led me to paint and draw, and then led me to want to be a songwriter, and also to want to have a beautiful life and a family. And yeah, I mean, I did bad stuff after I got out of that other place too, and went down some dark roads. And then at a certain point, I remember the last time I used, you know, hard drugs and stuff like that. And it's around 18 or so, 18, 19, right when I started writing songs. Mm-hmm. And I haven't since, you know.
Yeah.
Just turned 40. So it's like, it was a lifetime ago.
So did you find a relationship back with your parents then through songwriting?
Yeah. And also just like my dad's sobriety, like he's just, you know, he fought for that, and he really changed, and he's become, you know, over many, many years, been a mentor to me and a so supportive and someone I love and I'm so proud of, and he's been a mentor to me. And, you know, unfortunately he didn't get clean until after I was, I forget what age I was, maybe 20 or some, or maybe 22. I forget when it actually stuck.
Stuck, yeah.
Yeah, but it took, you know, it was a few, definitely more than one rehab trips, you know, and my mom too, you know, same deal, you know, sober. It took longer, but yeah, no, I mean, I'd say, you know, just the fact that they were able to do that makes me respect them, you know, and they're lovely people.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't change my experience. And I hope they'll never be like offended by me being honest about my own personal experience. I'm sure if they did a podcast, they could probably talk about me. And
we're going to have them on next week.
Yeah. If you have them on, you know what I mean? Like I was not a summer breeze, you know? And I'm not into like blaming or anything, but it doesn't take away like my experience growing up.
Yeah.
And in some ways I'm just really, really freaking grateful, because, you know, I'd have nothing to write about. and also just the empathy, like I'd have nothing to empathize about, because like I said, there were so many kids I met that just had it so much worse than me, you know, that didn't have parents, that didn't have like two parents, or didn't have, or both their parents were terrible, or they didn't say they loved them. You know, like my parents were sweet people, and I learned a lot from them, and they loved us, you know. They didn't, you know, so I was very, very lucky in a lot of ways, and they gave me a lot,
you know. Well, it's interesting about that, you know, I mean, certainly everybody knows what the blues is, but, you know, Ed and I were talking about this the other day, and my dad always comments, he's a huge Eric Clapton fan, but he always said, you know, his least favorite Clapton stuff is when Clapton has a couple happy points in his life, you know? And, but I mean, the poor guy's gone through so much hardship, and,
yeah,
you know, all this incredible music's come from it, you know? And I can think of some of my favorite songwriters, like, I'm sure there's things, you know, we talked about before we started recording, but, you know, and some, when we did, Jason Isbell, you think of, you know, Cover Me Up. I'm, you know, on the whole, the song is happy. He's found somebody, but he's talking about some really dark stuff, which
yeah.
makes that song so beautiful and amazing,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
So it's an interesting point to see.
Emotion.
Say, you know,
he's, yeah.
It's not as much light without the dark, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a fascinating piece.
He'd probably have similar stories, which, you know, it gives you, also gives you hope to know that people like Jason Isbell can go out there and be so proud about being clean and sober, and he's writing about these experiences, and he's, you know, he's giving hope to people,
yeah,
by being transparent and by being honest, and, you know, it's great, you know.
Well, speaking of pride, let's talk a little bit about and some of your proudest moments in your music career. Like what's like the gig you're most proud of? Like, you think back and you're like, that was a paramount moment, like that was the peak,
man,
or one of the peaks.
There's been so many, like, I mean, just starting, like, getting to Nashville, and of course, like, playing the Blue Verge is, you know, as a young, like, as a young, like, songwriter, is pretty.
I'm not that young anymore, and it is still a mecca I hope to at some
pretty
point
awesome,
be worthy of. Yeah, absolutely.
It's, you know, that's always cool. I proposed to my wife there. You know, it's a special place. I mean, there's been too many gigs, like, over. I mean, I do feel like these recent gigs, just like at 30A Fest, like, I had some fans that had been following me for a while, and they just came up to me and they just said, man, you know, we liked you before, but I really think you've gotten better. You know, like you've gotten better in the last year. You know, your voice has gotten better, or your presence, or your, you know, your, I could feel it more, you know, like that, you know, and I could feel it myself. And I know that comes from a lack of, and that comes from like not being so hard on yourself and just like being able to get up there and just show yourself.
Oh, and it's funny. It's like a chicken egg situation of, are you sounding in that way because you're not as hard on yourself? And are you not being as hard on yourself because you sound better? Like, you're more comfortable with the way you sound, you know?
Right,
it's a real
right.
Mindfuck. Yeah, it's...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, because you know, I'm a big believer in, like, you know, rehearse, like, practicing. I do vocal warm-ups every day. Like, I work on stuff like that so I don't have to think about it, like, at the show. You know, you shouldn't be thinking about it at the show, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you do that stuff. But then at the show, you really just need to be thinking about music and the song and all of that stuff. So I was really proud at 30A to feel like just like I belong there, you know, because there's, you know, some of the greatest songwriters in the world there. And I'm obviously not playing side by side with them yet. But like just to feel that you're on the right. Yeah, just to feel like you're on the right path or the right journey and that you're continuing to move forward, you know, as the, so some of those shows at 30A were really special to me.
Is there a gig or a venue or a stage or festival that you lay back at night and you're like, man, that would be it? Like, that's.
Well, there's so many really, you know, and I've gotten to play a few of them, but there's just so many. I mean, I guess you could think about Newport Folk or Red Rocks or like just kind of go down or, you know, all the beautiful theaters in Europe and stuff, that I haven't played yet. There's so many, you know, it's hard to think of just one.
Mm-hmm.
I think just being able to like do that consistently and just focus, like get to a point in your career where you're just really focused on writing and recording and touring, and then of course taking a break, you know, with your family.
Yeah.
But just knowing that you have enough fans to sustain that. Where I mean, right now I'm really grateful for the fans I have that have sustained my career and continue to do so. You know, it's just so I'm very happy with where I'm at. But if that just continues to move upward, like it has, it'll just continue. Every year will be. There'll be new stuff, and you'll never get bored with it.
So, is that a good cadence? You want to try and do a record a year?
I think you kind of have to these days. Like, I mean, like touring used to. What does my manager always say? Like, I mean, it used to be that touring fueled the recording, and like you could, you know, if you toured for 4 years straight, you could like. Push that recording for like 4 years, and now it's like recording, the new recording that fuels the touring.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have like a new single out, new video, new album, I can see it. It's like harder. It's harder to get those gigs, those festivals, that buzz. Like there's a very short attention span.
But there's also still to like some people are seeing you for the first time every time you play. You know.
Yeah. True. That's true. But yeah, to get some of like, I mean, to move forward and to continue to move the dial, I think you need to continue to put out stuff and hopefully put out stuff that's better than what you did before.
Yeah.
In some way, whether or be really proud of what you've done before, but know that you can grow in certain ways or maybe just try different things. Like I won't record another Stargazer next, you know, like, I have different goals right now. You know, I want to do something that's more live and just more emotional and just find that right thing and just hopefully it's the next thing forward for me.
Yeah, Jesse, we appreciate you coming in, man.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for listening to all my stories.
Thanks for sharing with us, and you're an inspiration as an artist, but also just your willingness to be vulnerable as an artist and also to share your truth.
Oh, thanks,
us.
Man.
Yeah, totally.
Thank you.
So much of yourself. So
thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, I'll leave you with absolutely, you and a few other people are the reason I got back into playing. I mean, I remember seeing that first show, seeing you do that, and be like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. Like, how could I not be doing this? And it was a really big deal for me. And I know some of it was Ed had worked it out, but he and I and Colin, who's in Mercy McCoy with me, but we got to open for you one of the times you came back through at the Hideaway like a couple years later. And that was just like this amazing moment for me because I was like, oh my gosh, he's coming back. And then we got to do that. And that was such a cool thing. So thank you for letting us do that.
Thank you, man.
It was really, really enjoyable for us. And it's super enjoyable having you do this show with us. Hopefully we'll have you back again for the next record.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Cool. We'll see you later. You've been listening to Song Divers.
Thank you for supporting us and our sponsors and all the great independent music makers out there trying to make their way in the music business these days. The opinions expressed by our guests are their own, and just to be perfectly clear, none of us recommend setting a fire as a solution to any problem. Songs we heard in this episode are Carrie, written by Jesse Terry and Maya Davies, and featuring background vocals from Kim Ritchie. That's from Jesse's Natural album. We also heard Let the Blue Skies Go to Your Head, written by Jesse Terry. That's from Empty Seat on a Plane. And we heard Stay Low, written by Jesse Terry and Edwall Till, from Jesse's Stargazer album.
A special thank you to Jesse Terry for spending time with us in the studio. You can hear Jesse's songs everywhere music is available. Follow him on Spotify, say hi on his social media channels, and get tickets for his next stop at jesseterrymusic.com.
And now if you could just sing an a cappella version of it.
Song Divers is a production of Ybor City Records and recorded in the historic Kenwood district of St. Petersburg, Florida.